today in Palo Alto.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, let me thank very much Paul Schwartz and the BCIT and all the partners organizing that conference to having me invited here to Palo Alto and therefore here also to be speaking to you on this issue. I'm very happy to do that in this time because we are in the core timing, as you said. I came here going from Strasbourg in France, where the plenary seat of the European Parliament still is, directly after we have voted. So I'm very happy to be here, and I was also happy to be able to follow the morning sessions, and I'm happy to also stay further. And I have to say that Professor Bamberger did quite a tremendous job to already explain a lot of what I would have been planned to explain on the regulation. So I have a bit of spare time to tell you about perhaps more on who I am and actually also why I'm doing what I'm doing. And I think that's something which people have asked me quite a lot throughout the last years when I was going back and forth, by the way, also between Europe and the United States, talking about transatlantic privacy and data protection rules. And I'm very much looking forward to do that even more in the future, because I think that we should not stop where we are to analyze that there is different cultures and different interpretations, obviously, still, like we have heard. I think that we should really walk ahead, and I think that it's not only about privacy or data protection rules, but it's also about building society and democratic rules for a digitalized and globalized world. And that's quite a challenge. Let me tell you, as I said, first, who I am. Actually, this is me, and I can look different, but it's very seldomly that it is so. So I've been a journalist during my studies and also after it, although that was quite a short time because I became a lawyer and a politician too quickly after it, and that to mix up that is quite impossible, especially the politician. But I think that there's more behind than these words. Actually, I was born 30 kilometers from the Iron Curtain. I grew up in a small town in northern Germany, and with 6 years, summer 1989, I just realized that it was that time, I was sitting in front of a computer for the first time, because my father was an engineer, having an old computer, a very big thing, for quite a lot of money, I guess. And since then, I was very much into computers. I was very much into everything what is with data processing at the end. And I had quite a lot of experience. And at the beginning, I wanted to become a technician or a legal in not a legal, but an informatic doing programming. And I also remember that with 13 years, I was into doing something with programming 3D games or whatever, because I have played these games and I wanted to program them on my own. So I learned from a magazine that there was something like 3D Studio. And it cost thousands of D-marks at that time. And so with 13 years, I went into the internet looking for a pirated copy of that. And actually, with a friend, with my best friend at that time together, we wanted to do that, and we knew we never would be able to buy that at that time. So we grabbed all the pocket money we had. So we took all these D-marks, going to a bank, changing it to $100, sending it to Malaysia, waiting for a copy to arrive. And at the end, it was there. And we did great movies for my school's newspaper, which I was working for the years after. And we were selling our copies with these videos. And that was great. A great time doing. And I think that that brought me at the end there where I'm here today also. So these are just a few stories of how I came to contact also with computers and with programs and data. But I also have to explain why I got into politics, I guess. The years after I had done my 3D videos and programs and whatever, I was getting away a bit of computers because I read books. I got interested into women or whatever, so it all got different. And then I ended up in getting engaged in activist groups on political issues in my region. And I have to tell that in my region, due to the geopolitical situation, there have been three nuclear waste storages. Because it was just near to the Iron Curtain. And on both sides, if you put your nuclear waste somewhere, you put it far to the other side. So that was what happened. And actually, one of it, already end of the 80s and in the 90s, collapsed. And it's just beside my home city. And still today, there's water coming in that storage, and it's quite clear that it will get out and that my region will be exposed to radiation. And that's an issue, a big issue today in Germany, this storage. It will cost billions of euros to get the thing out of it, and for sure, it, I think, will not be a good outcome at the end. But that brought me at the end, like Paul was mentioning, to the environmental movement. And I was getting into the Green Party. I was going to manifestations. I was even going to blockades of nuclear waste transports. Perhaps some of you have heard about these transports in Germany, which also raised protests. I was one of them. Getting also into conflicts with the law enforcement branch, and I was in the situation actually conducting my civil liberties, my civil rights to express my political belief in this, because I saw this is about a technical development which on the one side we obviously do not really have under control, and on the other side, which is minimizing our possibilities to decide how we are living in the future, or future generations might decide. So actually, that's really also a parallel, because it's about impact assessment of technology. It's about what happens if we use technology, and it's about political decisions and regulatory decisions about how technology can be used and how we want to live in society. That brought me there where I'm today also, and at least I think that I studied law, and especially international law and civil rights law also because of that. And I got into debates with the law enforcement side. I was into that made me actually a civil rights activist, first of all. The ICT lawyer came a bit later. But at that time, I got into debates with the law enforcement side. And I have to say, perhaps also as an answer to Thomas Brown, I don't know if he's still here. Hi. I think I would disagree on the point that there could be such a clear distinction between private and public data processing activities. Because if you look into what law enforcement is doing, and if you look into what society debates on security and effective law enforcement and responsible talk about law enforcement, we cannot allow, and I say it as a green civil liberties activist who is against blanket retention, for example, or metadata surveillance in that extent, what we have today, but we cannot allow to just say that we are not using the information which is there to do law enforcement and responsible security policy. That is the case, and society will not allow. So if we talk about data collection, we always also talk about government access to data. It is the case. You cannot just distinguish it. And although we are in a phase where we're debating of restricting government access to data, there are other phases in the past where it was exactly the different way. So, and it will happen again. And I think that such a differentiation is a bit blunt. So therefore, I would like to say, and I will come back to that in my presentation, that there is an issue with effective minimization of personal data. And I think that when talking about the challenges of today with globalization and digitalization, it's clear that we also have to talk about effective international enforcement, not only in law enforcement or in police and justice, but also in so many other issues. And we have to talk about common standards, therefore. There cannot be any further cooperation or opening of markets without talking about standards internationally. And that's, I think, what I'm here for also, and what I want to do. And when looking and at the international level, again, if you look into the ITU and into the actual international community in which we are, then there is, I would say, a two-thirds majority of non-rule of law-based non-democracies, which, for example, want to impose deep packet inspection. And again, it's clear that this is with regard to all data processings. You cannot technically distinguish and ask if personal data or any data or any information and ask this information, are you public or private when you're going through the cable? I mean, this is not possible. And I think we have to look into a common approach right from there where we are in rule of law-based democracies to find rules together. And I have to say, I think Andrew Servan has already left, but I would say that if we talk about imposing data protection or privacy rules, and he said that we shouldn't impose them on across the cultures or across generations, that sounds for me like we shouldn't impose traffic rules across generations or cultures. I mean, that's not what we should do. We shouldn't stand there not doing rules together, not finding standards together, only because everybody is different. Of course everybody is different, and of course we have different developments, but I don't think that it will end up good if we don't talk together and if we don't find a common denominators for how we want to live together. So I think that that being said, if I pin it down, I think it's really about this decision on can I protect myself also? Can I decide on myself which risk I want to take when I go outside to the streets? Which risk I want to take if I go communicating, buying, whatever, what you can do. So that's what we should talk about if there's the possibility also to do and responsible self-caring at the end in this digitalized environment. So having said that, I would like to, of course, get to the European Union's data protection reform, but I will keep it, as I said, a bit more shorter, as many things already have been said. So why are we doing the data protection reform, so the regulation in the European Union? More or less, the main issue is because, first, we have a directive from 1995, and there are quite a lot of issues which need to be addressed since then, and there is a need for coherent enforcement in the European market. We already heard it. There's very different interpretations, very different transitions in the member states. If you look to Germany, in 16 Länder plus the 28 different EU member states, it's about closing loopholes. And that, of course, is also because otherwise there's no trust and legal certainty to all of us. Doesn't matter who is searching for legal certainty, we all search for it. So, and of course, as a European, we say it's about safeguarding a fundamental right, and that's I don't think data protection is the right word for it. But at the end, it's the word standing in our treaty, and I will get to there. But what's behind, and that's where also we get to, is what has been the informational self-determination, the human dignity at the end also, which is behind determining on my own how I want to expose information about me. And, of course, we want to set an EU standard not only for our own market, but also to talk to others. And that's exactly what I say, a precondition for what we should do. So it's not the end, but the beginning, the precondition for common standards transatlantically and globally, and to manage the transformation to the digital and global society. And I think that's, by the way, not the smallest, but the biggest point. We are in a transformation which is, in my view, at least as big as the Industrial Revolution, and that means that there's more than just a theoretical legal process going on. It's really an educational and a society process and a dialogue which just has started. Looking into the past, of course, and where we are coming from, also the data protection issue comes at the end from the US, because the debates which have been here on privacy in the 60s have been swapped to Germany, for example, to Hesse, where quite a lot of US soldiers were situated at that time. And in Hesse, the first data protection law was passed in 1970, and that was even before the US Privacy Act was passed in 1974. And at that time, you already see that there's somehow this different philosophical approach on both sides of the Atlantic, due to different perspectives and due to different debates going on, of course. I think that the idea of data protection is, by the way, not protecting the data, but it's exactly the opposite round. It's protecting the human behind it, while privacy is protecting the human privacy. So self-determination in protecting in the protection of data protection is, as it was already said, more or less also an ethical issue. So I think that this is a debate perhaps which makes sense to reconsider also, if we should talk about something like privacy plus, because it's different than than talking about what about me when sitting in my own living room, if we talk about phones being our homes in our pockets. So it's or the Internet of Things. I think that we have to redebate also the philosophical basis, and therefore I completely agree we should talk about these different notions and what's behind, because it could bring us forward altogether. I don't want to reiterate all of what I have put on, but you can see that in 1989, one very important judgment of the German Constitutional Court has been passed, which is, I think, more or less the foundation of what is referenced today again and again on the concept of data protection as a fundamental right in Europe. And that has been implemented into EU member states and EU legislation and also the Council of Europe Convention. But you can also see that, as it has been said, also in Europe, governments should be careful when showing when pointing at the U.S. government when it comes to blanket surveillance. The data retention law passed in 2006 is something which is quite far going and which shows again that there's also an implication for private data collection when it comes to governmental access, because the Data Protection Directive at least opposes the imposes to the telecommunications providers to retain data and then to allow access to governments. That's where do we come from when it comes to our reform. Just as a small insight into the European Union more or less changed dramatically with the Lisbon Treaty, 2009. It's complicated also for Europeans to learn that, and still I think there's not such an awareness for the European Union at the end being also very near to a federal state. Quite a lot of Europeans would deny that, but legally you could think that this is true. And the Lisbon Treaty foresees in its fundament a constitutional principle, which is data protection as a human right, by the way. So everyone, also you in Europe, have the right to the protection of personal data concerning you. And then you see that this is also the legal base for the regulation to be adopted by the European Parliament and the Council, which still has to conclude this law. Then we have the Charter of Fundamental Rights, some of you might know. And there you can see that in paragraph 2, what are the ideas behind data protection in Europe? It's that data should be processed fairly. It's that it should be processed for specified purposes, on the basis of consent, that this is normally the rule, and exceptions to this should be possible, for example, on other legitimate basis laid down by law, and that everyone has the right to access to his data and to have it rectified, which means also, of course, to delete it. And that constitutionally there should be independent authorities, and that's already said that there are independent authorities in all member states overseeing that, and we need to work on that now. So we already heard that there's quite a bureaucracy already built, so this is the European Commission. It looks like a bureaucracy. It is. That's the institution I'm working in, the European Parliament, 750 members. So I would say it's quite comparable to the House of Representatives. We represent the 500 million European Union citizens being directly elected via the member states. The next election, by the way, takes place 22 to 25 May of this year, and we are elected for 5 years. So I'm working in for 5 years, and since then, I'm working on the data protection reform. That's not very important to look at, just that this is the committee and the council working group. So these are the two actual places where it takes place, the EU legislation. And we should acknowledge that this is the first working democracy above nations. So that's also quite an issue, and still, of course, it's a challenge to Europeans to get that done. It's a miracle that EU legislation is working. What happened until now? There has been a European Commission consultation process for 2 years. The European Parliament has passed a non-binding resolution at that time to ask the Commission to make a proposal, a single standard strengthening individual rights, but also incentives for companies to get better privacy done, sanctions and consistent enforcement in the European Union and its member states to achieve a single market at the end. We have had the Commission's proposal. The regulation is the heart of it, and it's for private and public sector, by the way, together. It's the same principles applying, but of course on law enforcement it's different. There's another directive. Directive means it has to be implemented. We have been appointed as rapporteurs in 2012, then hearings, meetings, discussions, and in 2013 we have had our laws being amended and adopted, and now 2 days ago there was a vote in the plenary. My work has been to get these 3,999 amendments down to a text. That took me almost a year. At the end, everything was translated into 23 different official languages of the European Union and printed. And that's the part in front of our meeting room of the Committee for Civil Liberties and Home Affairs being the lead committee. There have been four other committees also doing opinions on it. The core issues, of course, is the definition of personal data, so the differentiation also to anonymous data, which is, by the way, not covered by identifiable data. It's again important to say that. To create possibilities for real pseudonymization also, which allows further possibilities also for pseudonymized communication between controllers and data subjects. I think that's very important for technical standards, for example. To better specify consent, how it should work, specific, informed, explicit, what does that mean? The scope of application, we are creating a market location principle. That's the jurisdiction issue, of course. Like many markets, we are insisting on our market rules to be applied. I don't think it's so arbitrary. But of course, it poses challenges in a global market. And I say again, this is not the end of the story. It's the beginning. And we all should be forced to talk about rules which could open the markets in a way that we are at common standards. The huge issue on the household exemption, because it's important if we talk about how are we dealing with Twitter or other issues where people are obviously data controllers on their own also, where personal data is not only in the hands of professionals, but also of all of us. That's an important debate which we take. And as I said, private sector, public sector together, except, as I said, law enforcement is not covered by the regulation still, and intelligence services not at all, because that's not a competence of the European Union. It's the member states. And that's the crazy thing in it, because in the European Union, the whole national security area is chaos. So then, of course, there's legitimate interest as the opportunity for data processing without consent or contract. And quite a lot of people ask me, is it true in Europe it's everything based on consent? Not at all. Of course, there are quite a lot of exceptions. And as we have talked about that today, because Laura was also pointing at that, the reasonable expectation of the consumer is something which we debate in the European Parliament all the time. We have it for the last 2 years. We have debated it very extensively when it comes to legitimate interest, to data processing without consent, where I have the opt-out at the end and I should be informed about it. But is it possible to process data on that ground if there's not at all a reasonable expectation by the consumer to let that happen, especially with regard to the relation with the data controller? Rules on profiling. I mean, that's something which we had to look into, because in 1995, I mean, we talked about automated processing. That's like talking about the Stone Age seen from today. So we had to at least also limit it in a way and create rules for how profiling takes place, that there should be highly visible information also on the logic behind the processing. We brought in the ideas of privacy by design and default, which at the end also I think is kind of data minimization, because it's about the reasonable expectation to be met and not further. Better possibilities for certification and seals, privacy impact assessment I could add. And of course, there is also a risk approach, especially with regard to SMEs, because it's important to differentiate between the different ways of how to use personal data, and that's also acknowledged by the European Parliament. The issue of the corporate data protection officer is a core issue, of course, for the whole thing, and the European Parliament has, by the way, answered to the threshold brought by the European Commission that perhaps the number of employees is not any more appropriate of talking about the mandatory adoption of of a data privacy officer. We switched to a number of persons being subject to data processing activities. While this, of course, is still an ongoing debate, one has to say that we are not talking about privacy officers in any case being part of the company and a full-time job point. It could be also a compliance service from the outside being taken into account by the company. So this is an ongoing debate, but I think there are very much positive experience with this concept, as we already heard, because there is less consultation at the end. It also helps the data protection authorities to do their job properly if there's somebody taking care in the company, and it helps an educational process to take place. And I wouldn't underestimate that. I would say that this is part of managing the huge challenge of the transformation I referred to, also with regard to the technical background which is necessary. Of course, international transfers, that has been an issue based on EU law. We say again, if you transfer personal data from the European Union to the outside world, there should be the expectation that some basic rules in the European Union are met. And it's not only everywhere prior authorization. By the way, it's possible without prior authorization also. But there are some cases, for example, third states' authorities having access to data, where the European Parliament really made a clear point that there should be also application of some basic rules of the European Union, because the citizens there trust on our constitutional principles and our laws to be applied also. So I think that's a debate we have. And of course, we see nothing is perfect. Of course, we see that this poses questions with regard to the application of jurisdictions and to compliance with different jurisdictions. And we have to solve that. It's the responsibility of us politicians to solve that. And I really want to do that in the upcoming years. Consistency, that's more or less the core issue. The one-stop shop for data controllers and for citizens, by the way. So a company being subject only to one authority which oversees compliance, but also citizens being possible, being in the position to address their own authority in their own member state. That's an issue which is important for Europeans, because it's quite a problem if you're an Italian to address a Finnish authority. That's an issue which we take on board, but I think that we all have in mind consistency, and the European Parliament did a very clear stand on the one-stop shop. It's really clear that we want to create the single market where it's easy for companies from the outside to get compliance done with these rules. And, of course, we also want to create legal certainty, as I said, coordination between the data protection authorities. Today, we still have, although we have the Article 29 working party, very different interpretations between the authorities. And we have to improve consistency and coordination there. The European Data Protection Board will be the the new Article 29 working party. It will be more institutionalized. There should be, if it's with the parliament, a decision-making power also, with a two-third majority in conflicts, that there's really an answer given at the end. What is the single interpretation of these new single law? And that leads to a situation, hopefully, where there's at least less incoherent enforcement and illegal uncertainty for data subjects and data controller. Yes, of course, there has been a Snowden effect. And first of all, that effect has been on a diplomatic level. First of all, this impacts debates between political institutions, between political leaders, and this has had an impact on European leaders with regard at least to the spying on their activities. But I think that there's another very important point, and that's privacy and data protection, as it has been said also, is a competitive advantage. And I know that most of you will not understand the article, which I copied here in German. But I can tell you it's written that the NSA copies non-encrypted mails from Google servers. And there's an ad right next to it, which does advertising for Google Cloud Hosting. So this has happened, by the way, quite often in German media. So that's an issue. That's an issue in Europe, and I think also here. It has become an issue that there is a competitive advantage. And I think that, therefore, privacy is high on the political agenda for good reasons. And I know that not only on the political agenda, but also on the business agenda. And there is an international dimension which is so visible that everybody sees there's perhaps also no real possibility anymore to purely national solutions. I think that's also an important answer to regulators. It's necessary to come forward with national solutions, especially here in the US, but also in other third states. It's clearly, but I said it because of having perhaps national rules at the end instead of state rules. But I think also that for all of us, it has to be clear that we have to reach solutions above national solutions. But there's a missing parliamentary debate on transatlantic and global level. I can say that, although I know that it's growing, that it's improving, and as I said, I've been going to Washington one or even twice a year since five years now, and it's improving. But still, I think we have to make up our minds how we want to create, as I said, a democratic regulatory process on a level above of what we have done in the last decades or even centuries. And there's a need for trustful and effective regulation for the digital market. That's clear. So I have to be a bit more short. So I will skip that. That's a result which we had. The Council of Ministers in the European Union still have to do their job. As I said, everything complicated in the European Union. Get 28 ministers in one room, which all have their own public. And let them decide on one interpretation, that's almost impossible. But I think it will happen because the pressure is high, the public awareness is there. The big picture at the end, of course, also EU data protection, and I know it's a bit of a provocation that I said at the beginning that it could be an example for the US, but it won't solve all issues, and it's not perfect. That's with no political debate or legislation in the case. But at least the creation of a level playing field and better data control for Europeans, I think that's an issue which helps us building a way to find legal certainty and trust both of it. We need a joint effort for technical standards, the whole stack from processor design to the operating system. I think that free and open approach helps security and trust. So let's talk about open standards and openness also when it comes to the algorithms, or the logic at least behind processing. I think also we need to also have some investments into privacy. It shouldn't be only investments into breaching encryption, for example, then, but also into developing standards. We need to create a transatlantic level playing field. I'm a politician, so I need to give also some political insight on what I think we need to do. I really think that we need to have a digital declaration of independence, not of Europeans, but of all of rule of law-based Democrats in the world who care about building standards for privacy protection, for data protection, and also for standards which allow us to create a trustful market. I think that we need that, and I think that we need all those working also in these business sectors to come with us to do that. And somebody has to start, and therefore the European Union is doing that. And I think that it will have some impact on the global level. We don't have the majority, as I said, but we have some possibilities for some majorities working ahead in the European Union and in the US. I think that the world is watching this, that the EU data protection reform is a chance, which we have, and not a risk. It's a race against the clock. Form shopping will also reach the Silicon Valley at a certain moment, perhaps with Chinese competitors. I think that there is an ideal situation if there would be legislation also on national level in the United States. I think that would help us having a level on which we can talk about standards transatlantically and ahead. And as I said, competitive advantage, I think that will grow. So thank you very much. I'm happy to hear your questions and answer some more. Thank you.
So we have
Jan, that was terrific. We have folks with the microphones, and does anyone have a question?
Hi, thank you. So we know that the Europeans are really mad at the NSA, but we also hear that a lot of the most innovative and invasive work is being done by the British intelligence services. Are the rest of the Europeans equally angry at the British?
Yeah, I would say that there is a significant number which is at least equally angry on the GCHQ than on the NSA. Unfortunately, that's not the political leaders, and that has some source because, of course, for political leaders, knowing that they have lost control and on oversight on their side also. It's quite a painful issue to acknowledge that, and it's far more easy to just show with the finger at the NSA and the US government to answer that. So that's an issue, and hopefully that will change. The European Parliament, in this report which has been cited, we have voted this week also on the inquiry to mass surveillance, has pointed quite clearly on these examples in the European Union and has called on EU parliaments, member states' parliaments, and governments to fix their oversight instead of just looking at the US all the time. But still, it needs some time, and perhaps there the US could be a reminder for the EU to tell them.
Do we have another question?
I was especially pleased to hear your comment that data protection is really the protection of the individual. And I'm thinking about data, information, knowledge is power. And the accumulation of that, whatever we call it, data, information, knowledge, brings power to those entities that accumulate that substance. It appears as though in the European Union, you folks are more motivated by the way in which government would violate the rights of an individual, whereas we here in the States are more motivated by the ways that corporations would violate the rights of an individual. To what extent is the problem in the harmonization of international privacy law a reflection of differing motivations about protecting the right of an individual?
Very good question. First of all, let me try to perhaps correct the picture a bit, because I think that the perspective of EU citizens and US citizens is quite near on the issues today. It has changed dramatically throughout the last decades, and today I think for consumers on both sides of the Atlantic, they have the same debates going on when it comes to online privacy and to the challenge of safeguarding their own life somehow from threats, especially when it comes to their privacy and to identity theft and all these things. I think that it's not anymore that citizens in the European Union are more concerned about government surveillance. But of course they are, as US citizens are. I mean, I think it's more or less the same, that we have different legal cultures and so on, which has been evolved. That's the one thing. But on the other side, we are in a digital market which is more or less the same, and they realize the same developments. So therefore, I don't think that there's such a difference, and I don't think that this is impacting the way how we are regulating. The way how we are regulating is more impacted by the experience of what is effective in the view to regulate. You know, so there's different ideas of what is more effective, and we learn from each other on that, I think, not only in privacy.
Well, why don't we have another panel coming up. I'd like to conclude just by noting that in the current regulation, we see the adoption of ideas from Canada, privacy by design, which Anne Kavoukian, of course, has championed. We see adoption of an idea that began in California and the work of Deidre Mulligan on data breach notification. And, of course, in the U.S., the wide adoption and creation of chief privacy officers goes back to all kinds of European ideas, as Ken Bamberger and Deidre have also written about. And so there has been a transatlantic and a global dialogue, and I hope that we will continue it. And so what I'd like now is for us to have the next panel come up. But even before that, I would like to thank Ropes and Gray for our wonderful and delicious lunch. So thank you.
Thank you so much.